And we are back with an all-new episode of Keep It. I'm Ira Madison III.
I'm Louis Fertel. We are thankfully done with Halloween. I don't have to Tomb Raid anymore. I was original recipe Lara Croft for the second time. And I don't know what it is about me or gay men that are so into this character. She clearly has an anthropology degree, so maybe that speaks to us. I have no answer. I don't know. I can't explain it.
Well, to be fair, Louis, you have about 3 Halloween costumes that you have cycled through the 10 years I've known you.
Yeah, no, I believe it should be like swimsuits. You just own like a couple, and then they're like characters in your repertoire. You bring them back, and we're thrilled to see them.
Anyway, we are very excited to have a co-host join us this week. I've had the pleasure of being on her podcast for Colored Nerds. I've been on The Nod. And now she is the new host of It's Been a Minute on NPR. Welcome to Keep It, Brittany Luce.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here. Y'all didn't even know.
We're not nerds at all, though, so I don't even know why you would be excited about that. In fact, I'm insulted.
You do have the colored part down, though, Louis.
Oh, yeah. The color is unfortunately gray-pink. Yeah.
This is exciting because we just had Sam Sanders on, and I feel like, you know, he just passed the torch to you with It's Been a Minute, which mm-hmm. Louis and I have both been on in the past, so this feels like an entire, like, podcast cinematic universe.
I think that's pretty accurate. It's funny because, like, literally also he's hosting Intuit at Vulture, but also he has another show, Vibe Check, that was like, he and his co-host from Vibe Check were literally just on For Colored Nerds like a month ago. So it's just like, is it a multiverse or do all Black people in media know each other? What is it?
I think it's both. Yeah. We are very excited to get into our Halloween postmortem, I guess that's a pun, postmortem.
Yeah, I'll allow Halloween. It. Among pun-styled things from you, I'm going to allow it.
Thank you. We're going to get into Halloween costumes and things in a bit. We're going to talk about the long-awaited return of Rihanna. And what we think about that. So we also have an interview. Louis and I chat with Nina Hoss, who is fantastic opposite Kate Blanchett in Tar.
When real talent wanders its way into this Zoom, I mean, like, my instinct is to feel bad for them. Like, oh no, they're going to realize we're, you know, nerds. I mean, the word has come up again. But man, is she fabulous. And of course, fabulous in Tar.
You know, you could always tell a real talent is on this podcast when Hedda Gabler gets brought up.
Yeah, woof. And I brought her up like she was, you know, Mariah Carey ringing in the holiday season. So get ready.
And also, before we get started, we are reminding our listeners that this week is very important because it is the final few days leading up to Election Day. What some people call GOTV, get out the vote. And let me tell you, it took me an embarrassing long time as an adult to realize what GOTV meant.
Same. I thought it was a channel. I thought it was like Revolt or something like that, like back in the day. I was like, I don't get that one, I don't think.
Yeah, it seems like a deep in the dial channel, like near Reels channel.
Yeah, I was definitely like, I knew what get out the vote was. I was just like, sounds eerily like GOTV. But I'm not seeing the overlap.
Ira, what is your voting plan?
My voting plan is last minute voting in person because I've been back and forth from New York to LA so often that I don't even know where my voting booklet is. So I'm going to do it in person. I'm doing it in person. Mm.
Tommy Vietor is going to physically pick you up and remove you from the crooked universe for saying such nonsense.
I've got my voting guide. I know who I'm voting for, but I'm going to do it in person. And honestly, there's something about going to vote at the middle school by my apartment and saying hi to the people working and getting the nice sticker and walking out into the crisp November weather in LA.
No, I mean, the last time I went to vote in person a couple months ago in August, I saw Eric Adams. So outside of the club.
I'm sorry.
Your appearance outside of the club. I mean, you never know what you're going to get when you go vote in person. That's true.
I just want to say on this topic, somebody I know brought their kid to a birthday party recently here in LA, and Elon Musk was there. How about that? Just he's bone-chillingly just walking around somewhere, and you can just see him. It's really shocking.
I will say the one weird thing about Elon taking over Twitter is that he's reminding me a lot like Jack when Jack was running Twitter. Like when Jack would be like a nerd and respond to people's tweets for some damn reason. It made perfect sense for Elon Musk to be responding to Stephen King, saying when Stephen King said, $20 for a verification is maybe a bit too much. And Elon's like, well, we have to make money. Would you pay $8, Stephen King? What a loser.
Doing his little, Oliver act. On that front, of course he's responding to the celebrity who is basically calling him uncool. Like, it's only egotistical, that makes sense that he would respond to that. Anyway, I'm getting into my voting plan, which is I have my booklet right next to me and it has the sticker on it that I'm not peeling off until I actually do the work. But I'm going to go run it to the booth right down the street, which is, I believe, also at a middle school. I'm like a millennial. Pardon me. I'm Gen Z. I don't understand putting things in the mail. So I have to go walk to a station and drop it off. I'm 21 years old.
Well, we shared our voting plan with you all, and remember that Election Day is coming right around the corner. So make a plan, figure out who you're voting for, and go to votesaveamerica.com/volunteer, where you can find out more information about what you can do in your area. And if you live in Los Angeles, please do not follow Gwyneth Paltrow's voting guide that she put on Instagram.
Ugh. She should be forced to act again so she doesn't have the time to make these posts. I'm telling you, get into the Talented Mr. Ripley sequel.
All right, we will be right back with more Keep It. Rihanna has returned to the music industry with Lift Me Up, the lead single on the soundtrack to Black Panther: Wakanda Forever. And while the single was highly anticipated, I am no longer anticipating.
The anticipation period is over. We have done it. It was lovely while it lasted, and now we're moving on.
I thought it was pretty.
I actually concur. I think there's something engrossing about the song.
I don't know about engrossing. I think it's pretty. But I will say, I listened to it in the morning and I forgot about it by the evening. I forgot she put out a song. I forgot what the song was. I forgot how it sounded. I forgot the name. I'm trying to be respectful and thinking about it because I know she's like, oh, I did it for Chadwick Boseman and I adored him. And so I'm like, that's a lovely thing to do for somebody. But taking that apart, I don't know if it was it didn't move me to see the movie. It didn't move me to want to listen to the song again,
It's lovely. It feels like it's a tribute to Chadwick Boseman, but also I feel like sing it at a memorial or something. As the lead thing to a movie, and maybe it's going to be different when it rolls over the credits and I'm sad. And I've heard the movie is very stirring. But a lot of the responses from people defending it, knee jerk, were it's a tribute. What are you expecting from it? And music history is full of tributes to people who have passed, and those songs sound great. Candle in the Wind, for instance.
I was just going to say Candle in the Wind. Honestly, even Diddy's only, Diddy's best song.
Yes, yeah, right. I'll be missing you.
a tribute to Biggie. It's a great song. It's a great song.
I also feel another thing people are saying to defend this is, it's supposed to be a lullaby, to which were we all out here begging for lullabies? I mean,
she actually said, to fact check, Rihanna said, I'm not going to make y'all wait all this time and then come back with a lullaby. And what did she do?
Right. She here do? It is, lulling us. Right.
Are we not used to her lying to us?
That's true. She does lie constantly. But I'm just saying, let's say there was a Billboard Hot 100 lullabies chart. I feel like it would still come in at number 9. Like, people are not thrilled about it. Secondly, it also feels to me like the end of a song, not an entire song, which I think is the main problem.
I think I agree. There's like, I mean, this is the thing. Rihanna is kind of, in a way, a pop ballad princess. So I don't think it's strange that the song has a lullaby quality. I don't think it's strange that the song is not upbeat. I saw these tweets where people are like, y'all wanted Rihanna to do a tribute to Chadwick Boseman that sounded like, you know, Wild Thoughts. And I'm like, no. What I wanted was something maybe a little bit, you know, you mentioned, Ira, that the film has been said to be stirring. Like, I think that Diamond, you know what I'm saying? Like, Diamonds, that's a stirring song. And I think that, like, I don't know. I just feel like there was a piece of the song missing, like the bridge, or like, I didn't feel like it built to anything. I think it's pretty as it is. And I love Thames. And, you know, I'm glad that she wrote the song. I'm happy for her. I love to see her success. But I just feel like from both of these artists, for a movie such as this, huge occasion, this is a tribute to Chadwick Boseman, beloved actor, who's not going to be in the sequel. It just is so strange to me that they made a song with no, you know what I mean? Like, there's no...
No oomph. There's no, yeah, no oomph.
Yeah.
There's... And also, pre this, people were excited for this song because we want Rihanna on the red carpet at the Oscars, you know? We want her to shut down the red carpet. And this doesn't even feel like a song that would be nominated for an Oscar, you know? Like, it's barely even Skyfall.
You took the words out of my head. I was thinking, like, Skyfall, that is a great, Skyfall by Adele, great Bond song, and super into it. That is one, I don't know, it's kind of, that when I think about like a big blockbuster film ballad, like a Skyfall or, you know, that sort of thing, I feel like you just got to go big. You've got to be Shirley Bassey. You've got to be a little bit like, not to say that Adele herself is cheesy, but I think she was channeling some of like that 50s, 60s flair with Skyfall in like a way that I think was like cheesy in a good way. I feel like you kind of have to go for it a little bit. Like, I don't know. I mean, think about like, okay, Prince of Egypt, baby, when you believe, okay, that's what I'm talking about. Like, I just feel like Rihanna should have gone in that sort of direction. I think I don't know if you can play it pretty and cool when you're doing like an Oscar winning type of ballad for a film.
Also, it's strange because we're in a year where it's a very star-studded cast of potential nominees in that world, where like Lady Gaga might get in for Hold My Hand, another song where it's like, what, there's a missing element here. It's like they forgot to make an entire song. They like put down 75% of it, and then, you know what it sounds like to me, you know the famous story of Prince made When Doves Cry, and then he's like, what's the last thing I can do to make this magical? And he took out the bass line, and then somehow it became more amazing. This, it feels like they took something out, thought it was better, and in accidentally they deleted most of the song.
The rest of the song is on Lana Del Rey's computer, actually. it's just missing now. Speaking of Hold My Hand too, like, if that's supposed to be in the soundtrack category, that song isn't giving either.
No. I have friends who claim that that's like the most emotional part of the movie. It's right at the end. His relationship, Tom Cruise's relationship with Miles Teller, is solidified. Before that, he, you know, reunites with Val Kilmer in the movie, and it sort of culminates with that song. Meanwhile, even just the words "Hold My Hand," like, Hootie did that. Like, we don't need to revisit that.
It is. It is not the most emotional part of that movie either. Like, you get to the end of the movie, and, you know, if you're a man, especially a man who loves Tom Cruise like me, you're already crying him, you know, reuniting with Miles Teller. But then the end feels like a coda. And then what? He walks up to, he's there at the car. And then you just hear Lady Gaga wailing, hold my hand, hold my hand. And I'm like, this is actually taking me out of the film. And out of the theater.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I feel like there's just like these, I don't know if movie soundtracks are hitting the way that they used to hit. I feel like, I mean, they always have been, not always, but I would say at least for the last 30, maybe 40 years, they've been used as like a promotional tool. But now sometimes it feels a little too naked, if that makes sense. Like, I mean, okay. Like even like Will Smith's Men in Black song, again, has a specific cheesiness to it. It obviously was a marketing ploy. He knew that he was a famous rapper, I guess, at that time. And he knew he wanted to be Mr. 4th of July. But there's still like, it still feels like a complete song, whether you love it or whether you hate it. It still feels like a complete song. And I think that it absolutely hits with like the 10-year-olds they were trying to reach who wanted to see Men in Black. Whereas like, I don't know, I think that for a film like Black Panther, which kind of bills itself as, I think, a lot smarter and more textured than your average superhero movie, you kind of want to have a more textured ballad to go with it. Or even like, I never saw Top Gun. I realized recently I'm just now starting to watch Tom Cruise movies. He just wasn't really a part of my life until 3 months ago. And so I went in to see Top Gun 2, like with knowing nothing. I left in tears. I didn't know any of the references. I didn't know who they were referring to. I'm glad that they repeated everything so much for people like me because I didn't know what the fuck was going on. But by the end, I was crying. I felt like that movie was satisfying in every single way. And then, like you said, we get to the very end. And yet, you know, and then we have Lady Gaga, who, by the way, hair, body, face. Why did you do that? I mean, the entire Star is Born soundtrack. Had me in a chokehold. I was getting up every day at 6 o'clock in the morning and playing it from my phone in the bed, singing in my husband's face. He was so disturbed. But like, that's what I'm expecting from Gaga when she's on a soundtrack. And I kind of wish to have a film that was so satisfying in every other way. I wish that Gaga had a satisfying song to go with it, you know?
And she tried to oversing it into being a better song too, which only pointed out where it was lacking. And I mean, God loved the girl. I mean, like if Lady Gaga didn't exist, there would be like an ozone layer sized hole in popular culture. I really think she's important just in the breadth of strange material of unbelievable earworms she's given us, but just not that song. Also, it's like, again, there have been some bad songs that have won Oscars in recent years. You know, like we had like the Writings on the Wall. No Time to Die is fine, but like, does anybody really even know that her song that won? You know, so I feel like the category is like dripping lately.
Does anyone actually know her songs, or does she just appear at award shows?
Right. Yes.
inexplicably walking away with an award like Carmen Sandiego. Like, how did you get in here?
But you know what though? Like, but I don't know. Like, that's kind of the best career to have. Like, everyone's like, who is she?
It?
Where did she get? How did she get here? I've never heard her sing. I've never heard her speak. And then look out, 5 years, this girl will probably have an EGOT. And nobody will know not one song. That's a goal.
She truly will. I feel like I went to Camp Flogna a few years ago. Uh-huh. And honestly, I stopped over at her set and it was really good. She knows how to put on a fucking live show. Mm-hmm. I did not know a single song. But I was feeling it. Mm-hmm. You know? So shout out to her. Going back to what Lewis was saying about even like the Men in Black or something, that is what a movie soundtrack is supposed to be, though. It's a promotional tool, but also it's supposed to be a thing where 20 years later, whether or not you've seen the movie, you know the movie because you know the song that was in it, you know?
Exactly.
Like, you know, like I can still hear Hero from Spider-Man, Chad Kroeger's Hero.
I was bumping that the other night. I was like, not me listening to Nickelback in the bed. Like, that song is good. That song is good.
Yeah, it's a really good song. And it's something that needs to connect you to just the images that are in a film. I mean, you know, the soundtrack era isn't really here anymore when you don't have a music video that intersperses clips from the movie with the video, like,
exactly.
Are You That Somebody or Try Again?
Right.
Aaliyah's two of her best songs, which were soundtrack entries.
And by the way, I just want to say, literally, every time, and this song is still everywhere, I feel like the peak years of it being ironically played everywhere are over, but I still hear it. Smash Mouth's All Star. When I hear that song, I am immediately zapped to the video from Mystery Men.
Right.
Where,
yes.
And I'm telling you, I know Janine Garofalo thinks that's a curse, but her image comes to mind every time I hear that fucking song. And also like Wes Studi, what a weird cast. But like that is successful marketing. Like my God. And that also is from the TRL era where we were like fixed on watching music videos, not just one time, but 70 times.
That's a good
shout out though to a song that is, the entire video is Mystery Men and it came from that soundtrack. But if you ask most people what movie that song is from, they would say Shrek.
Yeah, right. Yes.
I didn't think about that. It's absolutely true.
Double duty. Okay. My question, and I was getting into a debate with a friend about this weekend. Do you prefer a movie soundtrack where it's like commissioned, these are all new songs for it, or do you prefer a film where it's like the director has crafted
jukebox
songs that like jukebox something, or you know, like a Tarantino film, you know, where like all the songs on that are specifically what was inspiring the director each scene, they're all in the scenes, etc. Or do you want just a commission thing where it's, you know, Diddy gathered a bunch of people and we're going to make songs based on the feel of the movie? Ooh. Barely based on the feel.
That's a really good question. Well, I think that, okay, I admire the ambition of commissioned music. Because I think that like when it, like even if it doesn't go well, you kind of like you can usually get a couple interesting songs out of it. But when it does go well, it goes so well. However, I think I do kind of prefer to listen to most frequently sort of the jukebox one. Like also I think about a film like Forrest Gump, like the Forrest Gump soundtrack, which like is straight up jukebox, like straight up just like some of the most popular music in America from like the 40s through like the 80s. And I think that like they do such a good job of placing you back in the film. Well, when it suits. I mean, there's also certain, like I think about like Saturday Night Fever.
Oh, sure.
I mean, I mean the Bee Gees, first of all, like.
Who literally. I'm sorry, I said this before to Ira. Who gave these white men the right? Why is it so good?
I mean, I'm saying, how did this happen? Like, not me. I mean, literally, I listen to them all the time and cry because their voices are so beautiful. Like, that to me is almost like, I actually don't remember. I'm sure I learned it watching the Bee Gees documentary on HBO. But I don't even remember whether it was commissioned or whether they based stuff in the film around the music that they had already made. But like, I kind of think that the ultimate film soundtrack is when you kind of can't tell, right? You kind of can't tell whether it was commissioned or whether it was just like exactly what was going to work perfectly for the film at that time. So like, again, going back to the A Star Is Born soundtrack, obviously those were commissioned because they had to be worked into the film. But I mean, like some of my favorite Lady Gaga songs, some of my favorite Lady Gaga performances, vocal performances come from that soundtrack. So technically they're commissioned, but also it does like, I don't know, it does still kind of feel jukeboxy in a way. But yeah, I mean, I also like have a deep affection for musicals, and I more recently begun to understand animated movies. I was never really that into cartoons as a child. And so like as an adult, I really couldn't get into them. But when I saw Coco, I flooded the theater with tears, first of all. And then second of all, I began singing Remember Me or Recuérdame, both in English and in Spanish. Every single day, first thing in the morning. I don't know how I got married after that, actually. I'm really impressed. I got proposed to a year later. So that's a tip for ladies out there. Coco Centric will get it done. But yeah, I kind of think it can work best when it's like when it's commissioned, but it still feels like with very within the world of the film, like a Superfly or something like that.
All right. Well, favorite movie soundtracks from all of us, go as right. Last.
I'll throw it down quickly. I will say Magnolia, which I've brought up recently on this podcast, but obviously Paul Thomas Anderson wrote the movie inspired by the music of Amy Mann. She ended up writing more songs in turn for it, used some songs that were like lying around on an album that she couldn't get out basically until she bought back the masters and released it herself. But anyway, I just love that the dryness of her emotional songwriting and also the humor in her emotional songwriting. Like, you just believe people when they're a little bit funny. Like, it really makes the emotional heft of the song feel like it really has sat with them, that they have a sensibility about it that can be a little bit sarcastic or acerbic. I will say there's a caveat here. There's a line in the song Deathly that kicks it off that goes, "Now that I've met you, would you object to never seeing each other again?" And he literally uses that line in the movie. And I have to tell you, it's the cringeworthiest part of the movie, because song lyrics do belong in songs. Like, it's actually hard in a way to criticize when a song lyric is quote unquote over the top, because, well, you're not supposed to say it literally also. So I felt like that was actually instructional to me. Like, song lyrics can be great, but they're contained in the space they are for a reason. Don't go put them in movies.
Mm. I think that's a really, really, really excellent question. I think that my favorite, like as in the one that I've probably listened to the most in my life, I mean, probably number one is going to be probably the original Lion King soundtrack.
Sure.
I wore that completely the fuck out as a child. And then as a teen into my adult years, actually the About a Boy soundtrack from like the film with Hugh Grant. I am a big Badly Drawn Boy fan. I am the only Badly Drawn Boy fan I know, unfortunately, also. And so I've never been to any of his concerts or anything like that. But I think that one was probably commissioned. Like, there's a lot of really great instrumental tracks that like you hear at really beautiful, crucial points throughout the movie. And I think it's a really good example of how like digital production, like digital music production, had a really strong aesthetic in the late 90s, early 2000s that worked really well, like laid with traditional like string and woodwind instruments. So if you haven't seen the movie, it's actually a pretty good movie. I'm a big fan. I think it's one of Hugh Grant's best performances. And also you get a young Nicholas Holt. And obviously, you get the Queen in that film as well. But I think that the soundtrack is also like a lovely surprise. And even if you're not super into Badly Drawn Boy, I think it's a really good film soundtrack.
I love About a Boy, and I will say that like it made no sense for me, sophomore in high school, right. Going to see this movie and like having intense emotions about Hugh Grant raising this boy. but you know, a film with daddy issues will always get me. Anyway, I could say for me, favorite is, you know, like something like Waiting to Exhale is like always like an all-time classic.
Yes,
yes. But, you know, you said Paul Thomas Anderson, and I routinely listen to the Boogie Nights soundtrack.
Oh,
well, the year is 1977. That's when all the good stuff came out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just the songs in that.
Yeah, Best of My Love
Emotions.
Are some
of the classics of the... Yeah, mm-hmm. Best of My Love and Spill the Wine.
Yes. Oh my God, it's such a key scene in the film too.
Yeah, yeah. Really, really. And yes, of course, Best of My Love, like it reminds you too of the film, that sweeping tracking shot of the club that opens the movie, and just perfect soundtrack.
With Roller Girl zooming on through everything. Yeah.
So good.
Yeah, our favorite Keep It guest, Heather Graham.
Moving on. Yeah, no, but you're right. This conversation does have me nostalgic, though. It does feel like a bit of a lost art to just compile the correct songs from a movie that really summon different scenes from the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Also, shout out to Empire Records. Sorry.
Shout out Empire Records. Too.
Yeah, you know, people in their late 40s now will never shut up about that movie.
same vein, Stealing Beauty soundtrack I really like too. That has a little bit of Liz Phair on it.
Yeah. All right. When we are back, Lewis and I chat with Nina Haas about Tar and much more. Our guest today is a German film actress who is truly an icon. And we are excited to talk to her about her some of her best work. And that includes Barbara, includes Phoenix. You know her from Homeland. And most recently, Tar, opposite Cate Blanchett. We're very excited to chat with Nina Haas today on Keep It.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. Thank you for the icon. I had no idea.
You've earned it. You've earned it, okay?
Thank you very much.
Nina, thank you for being here. And I have to say, can you believe you were in this movie? And can you believe, I mean, just not that you're not amazing in it. You are absolutely amazing in it. I can't think of a movie in recent memory that sits on my brain like this movie does. I like can't lose it. I can't. It's not even that I'm confounded about what I think about it. It just lingers so much. Like the feel of the movie is so strong. You guys are all so virtuosic in it. And I was wondering what you think it is about this movie that doesn't leave people's heads.
You know, I have the same experience with working, having read the script, having worked on the film, and then having seen the film now 3 times. And I still want to watch it again because I still think, even though I have been part of that whole process, I've missed something. There's still something else I can explore. And I think that is the great force of this film, in a way, that it opens a room for conversation. It makes you think. It makes you rethink your own judgment about several topics that float around us right now. And certainly about power abuse, but also about how, what does it mean to lead an institution, to be a creative while trying to change the institution, maybe. Can you still be a creative if you come to a certain point in your life, like Tar, where you've kind of reached everything you could be longing for and you're working on your legacy, are you still able to be creative? So it's about so many things, how to treat people, how to love, how to live, you know. It touches so many things in such a beautiful, unjudgmental way. And on top of this, it's very intense. And it's there's so many things coming at you. And the great thing is that I have the feeling, also when I talk about people who have seen the film, that they're engaged. So they want to know more about it. It's not that they feel like, oh my God, I don't know what the hell they're talking about. It's about classical music. I don't know anything about orchestra. No, you are taking into this world and you want to learn more about it. And that, of course, also has a lot to do with the intensity of Cate's performance. And you're just fascinated by it. You know, you want to follow her into this world and into her world. So, I must say I feel the same. And I can't quite believe that I have a part in this. It's really, because I myself feel sometimes like an audience. Still exploring it.
Well, I have to wonder, you know, being such a prolific German actress, you know, and you shot many things in Berlin, what was it like having a bulk of this film taking place sort of, you know, on your turf, as it were?
Yeah, it helped me. It helped me for Sharon, which is the character I play. So I am the wife of Tar, of the character that Cate plays. And for me, that was crucial that she, Tar is in Sharon's world. So Sharon has her family in Berlin. She can speak the language perfectly. She is good friends with all of the orchestra members. She has been there for much longer than Cate did. And I had... that helped me a lot of just for having a feeling for where Sharon comes from. And then I had the feeling that it kind of rubs off the film. You see Berlin, you see, you feel it's somewhere other than, you know, it's not Atlanta or, you know, in New York or it's Berlin. It's the colors, the, the way it's shot, the sometimes static, you know, and all these things, I was really surprised in a good way when I saw the film for the first time, and I thought, oh, there's a lot of Berlin has rubbed off on Todd.
I left the film with some friends, and I just want to say each of them who hadn't been to Berlin before were like, they wanted to go, and they wanted that apartment.
Yes, both apartments, yes, actually. Me too.
Even Tara's, you know, bachelor pad, they wanted that one too. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, that was fabulous as well, because this is really an apartment. It's the way you see it in the film. That's how it exists. It's beautifully, you know, pieces put together through, I don't know, many, many years of that beautiful couple that gave us this apartment to shoot in. And for us as a couple, it felt really lived in. You felt at home. That was very special. And every time we all came in, we were all like, oh my God, this is so beautiful. And at the same time, of course, also a bit gloomy if you light it in the right way. You know, it has everything. It can be a very lonely space and a very cozy, comfortable space.
Yeah. Part of the mystique of the movie is your relationship with Tar, and we as the audience are figuring out that there's a lot of genuine affection there. You're the first violin, she's the EGOT winning maestro. But also there's something transactional about your relationship. We're figuring out, like, you know, what are you getting from it? What's she getting from it? And I have to wonder, how much of this is something you sorted out in rehearsal? And is rehearsing with Cate Blanchett a particular vortex that you fall into? I mean, I imagine she is thrilled to meet someone like you who is, you know, as much a genius as she is.
I think we were both so thrilled to be able to work with each other, because I am fascinated with her work and always have been. I admire her a lot as an actor. And so it was, for me, I was very curious to see how we could dance with each other. And it was just very, she used the word actually once, and I think it describes it very well. It had some kind of, it was effortless. So it's just where, you know, you're prepared, you've asked the questions, you discuss things. We also kind of learned, we had played similar, because I'm also a stage actress, so I had played Hedda Gabler, I did Medea, she did Elektra, she did Groß und Klein, which is really a very German play. In Australia, and I did the same. It's a fantastic, fantastic character in there, Lotte, who is somewhat, you know, someone who believes in humanity and gets so terribly disappointed by humans. And it's a wonderful character. So we knew, we seemed to have the same kind of taste in characters and the way we want to portray them and what we're looking for. And to, in a way, what Tara says also, to obliterate your ego and just explore. And so if you have someone like that as your partner, you can really just start the scene and see what happens. And that was is just phenomenal. And it was an incredible experience to work with her.
I feel like there should be some sort of convention where just actresses who've played Hedda Gabler can get together and just unpack the... what must go into something as insane as something like that? I mean, how many people just have like the gumption for it? You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a phenomenal female character. And you can read her in so many different ways. Somehow has also something to do with Tar, I would say. It's just someone you don't quite understand why she does the way she does the things the way she does. And at the same time, sometimes you're appalled by it, but you're always fascinated. So that is also true for Hedda.
What do you think the film says about identity, you know, and about who we are as people?
It's, to be totally truthful, I didn't really think about any of it while doing it. And we didn't really discuss it either, because we just explored from scene to scene, what is it? If someone feels, is there power abuse going on? Is there something going on that's not quite right? Am I saying something now, or do I look the other way, or should I always say something? Should I stand up for someone who then doesn't appreciate it? And all these complications, you know, that come along with it. And like you said earlier, Louis, also for Sharon, doesn't she get a lot out of this relationship as well? She is deeply in love, that I'm sure of, but she also knows that it forwards her career as well. You know, she gets to do things that she couldn't do with another conductor, and she both of them are in a very powerful position. So I didn't actually think about, oh, it's two females in a powerful position. I just love that Todd wrote the script as if this is the most normal thing that could be. And of course, knowing as the actor that's behind it and watching films and so on, that this little trick, let's say, that it is a female, allows the audiences of today to not be so quick in their judgment. You kind of listen a bit longer. You want to understand a bit more before you make up your mind about someone and the people around her in this case. I think if it would have been a man portraying this character, it would be much quicker, firstly, in the draw of the Me Too discussion, which is nothing I think that Todd intended. He just really wants to open up a conversation. And that's why we were so interested in being part of it and doing the same in a very careful, nuanced, hitting all the gray zones way, you know. So I think we don't want to give an answer to identity, I guess. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I had a question about, what is it like doing American film press as compared to German film press? And the reason I ask this is, looking at some of the movies you've done, I mean, you are just somebody who is prepared for anything. And I mean, it gets pretty fucked up sometimes. Whereas I feel like we're kind of not used to, you know, movies really existing outside of boxes we're familiar with over here. So a movie like Tar, which I would consider pretty extreme in certain ways here, pretty extraordinary, must in certain ways to you feel kind of commonplace for you in your career. And I was wondering how... is American press kind of different than German film press, which I'm just guessing is more sophisticated than we are?
No, they're not. Calm you down. No. It's, you know what's beautiful with the American press, and I'm not saying it to schmooze anyone. So it's just, you know what you're talking about, and it's a really. I always feel you're interested in it and you get something out of it and you want to know more about it and you have references and you've seen things and you know the filmmakers, you know the people in it. It seems important, you know, and it's a very important to me because it's my life. And in Germany, that's sometimes not the case because, believe it or not, I think in our culture, theater is still the one art form for actors and directors that is considered the real true art form, you know, the one that is really being taken seriously. And so sometimes with film, it's sometimes a bit less intense or serious, or it's less about the work, really. It's more about everything around making films, but not so much about the content in interviews, not in the reviews. The reviews are sometimes very sophisticated. That's true. But don't worry. You're doing very well. I love talking to Americans about film.
Oh, yeah. what a relief for us. No, we should be putting that on a billboard around all around America. Nina Haas likes us. Yeah.
Oh, yes, I do. I do very much so.
This film reminds me a bit of one of your earlier films, which I'm sure you've talked so much about, Phoenix. But for me, it's, you know, it's about betrayal from a partner, and just sort of, it's interesting seeing you a decade ago playing that role, where you sort of, you know, taking a driver's seat in this betrayal, but you also, you don't really know how you whether you're a victim or whether or not you are taking control and feeding. So I feel that's sort of the same here. Do those type of roles sort of interest you? The ones where your character is just sort of, you could play it one of two ways, you know, and the audience isn't really sure what you're delivering until the end.
Yeah, I guess something draws me to those characters because I don't quite understand their motive at the very beginning, but there's something mm-hmm. intriguing when I read it, and I want to explore it because, well, in Sharon's case, it's like, why? Who's a woman who's with someone like Tar? And why would you? What do you get out of it? And in some way, you're right. She is a victim, but then on the other hand, not at all. You know, and it's for me interesting. It's the same with Phoenix, that it's women that are very open, that are, in Phoenix's case, very wounded, of course, in Nellie's case, the character's name. But there comes a certain point where they take their life into their hand again with all the consequences. Mm-hmm. And that is a slight parallel with Sharon. That it comes to, it seems like their core is still intact. And so for me to explore how to get to that point where these women say, okay, I get some of it, and I know now I have to do something else. I need to take it into my own hands, and I take responsibility for it. That that I find, you know, it's such a stupid word, strong, but it's something, it's of interest to me. Let's say it that way.
Well, Nina, I will speak on behalf of Ira and say, hope you are part of the Best Supporting Actress story coming up in the next few months here. I don't know how much an Oscar means to someone from Germany, but we need to be considering you in a serious way. It's just a tremendous performance and an unforgettable one. I thank you for giving it and coming here on Keep It.
Oh, thank you so much. I won't say anything. We're super superstitious here, coming from the theater. Let's see where it takes us.
Fabulous.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Thank you for having me.
Tar is in theaters now, and season 3 of Jack Ryan, which Nina Haas is also serving in, premieres December 21st. Halloween has come and gone, and at this point, it's become a tradition for celebrities to dominate your Instagram feed with their costumes. And let me tell you something. I feel like I've reached maybe a slight tipping point on this, because I feel like, as you know, you have so many friends who put effort into their costumes, that they also have to be wearable, and you see them out at parties, and it's just fun to see like how much work a friend or someone else has put into a costume. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. I'm not impressed by a celebrity with a lot of money who just pays someone to come and do their makeup and do a photo shoot in their house to put it on Instagram. Like, that's not Halloween.
Say that.
And additionally, like, yeah, well, here's the thing. When it comes to like the Kardashians or the Jenners or whatever, I do feel this is a tax they should pay as celebrities. Like, they should be able to deliver on this level, you know, like Kendall Jenner coming in with a pristine Jessie the Cowgirl outfit. I'm not saying it moves me. I'm not saying like, oh, that really added something to my day. But at the same time, good. You
it's
are
expected.
Providing for us.
It's expected.
Yes. Good.
Yeah. It's the bare minimum.
Yes, it is the bare minimum. Yes.
I feel like I at least approved of, say, Lori Harvey doing the Beyonce videos, because she dressed up as multiple Beyonce videos and also made little music video segments to go with them too. Like, that's taping it a step further.
Mm-hmm. No, I 100% agree. I think my favorite celebrity Halloween costume from this year I mean, there's certain celebrities I will say that, like, I think that Lizzo does a really good job because she'll give you different specific looks in different contexts. And I like that. And there's like some that she shared that are more specific to TikTok, some that are general pop culture, some that require photo shoots or videos. I'm into that. Giving me a full moment of production. But my favorite was Lil Nas X dressing up as Ice Spice.
That was iconic. And I don't know how I all of a sudden became, I think it actually, for I liked the song Munch and I liked so Bikini good. Bada, but I think Lil Nas X being in the Ice Spice outfit actually made me an Ice Spice stan. Like, I'm fully standing now. And that is the power of a really good costume.
It is the power of a really good costume. And also, like, I love the fact that his costume didn't have all this, it didn't require a bunch of bells and whistles. Like you see a lot of these celebrity costumes, you know what I'm saying? Like you were just saying it, like they've got like their hair and makeup and wardrobe teams that are giving them this full look. I felt like his costume could have been repeated like by anybody, could have been copied by anybody. But also I have to say shout out to Ice Spice because it's very hard to be iconic in the literal sense, I would say, when you first come out. To the point where like people can actually identify iconography in the way that you present yourself. I think it's really impressive that somehow this girl has like the red curly Annie, like literal orphan Annie hair. like that's iconography for her now. And also what is it? Almost like that like black body stocking with all the holes in it. Like, mm-hmm. Hayley Williams from Paramore wore one of those at a performance last week. I don't even think trying to emulate Ice Spice, but people saw Hayley Williams' red hair and they saw her wearing that body stocking and they were like, look at her in her Ice Spice era. But I mean, shout out to Ice Spice because it's kind of amazing that like through the way that she puts herself together, she has like what, two songs out? She just came out this year. That she was able to, like, she's, what's the word I'm thinking of? She has enough of like consistency visually that like people could see someone dressed up as Ice Spice and immediately know who she was.
So, I want to bring up, you just brought up Lizzo. She and Cardi B both dressed as Marge Simpson, which,
I saw that.
How wild is that? Yeah. I can't think of an occasion in recent Halloween history where two people really went as both, not just the same thing, but like, not that their take is the same, but it's the same jarringness watching them dressed up as Marge Simpson.
Right, right.
I also appreciate it that they both did something different with it, you know? Mm. Like Lizzo did the full photo shoot, and then Cardi B had the whole, like, she'll always be running around in a house doing something funny, too.
Right. Yes. So also, we can't go any further without bringing up Heidi Klum, who I believe is like the unholy emperor of Halloween. Where
I think she started all this.
Yeah. It's like, look, she dressed as an earthworm. And by the way, it's not an ordinary earthworm. It's giving the earthworm from James and the Giant Peach, the claymation version. So I don't know if you've seen that movie recently. I would describe it as nightmare inducing. I mean, there's just like these Roald Dahl creatures should not be scurrying up a peach. It's just not right. It's not what God wanted. But she looks amazing. She also lies down on a red carpet as an earthworm. So she's really committing to like the disgustingness. Like she's a German vermin, as it were. But it's kind of what you're saying, where all I can think about is what a nightmare this must be for the aide assistant she has or whatever. Like, are they calling up Rick Baker to make sure he can, you know, do the 8 pounds of makeup on her face and body that she needs so that this can be pulled off without a hitch? Because it is without a hitch. Not a single, what are those things called on an earthworm, segment is out of place.
Mm-hmm. I would also say that I prefer some people's vintage outfits. There was I love the Pop Culture Done 2009 Twitter thread and Instagram because they always have fun throwbacks. And, you know, you saw like Kim and her, that man she used to be married to's old, like Batman and Catwoman costumes. And it's just like that in 2012, like, yeah, it still seemed like they were, you know, like getting regular costumes and going to the club and, you know, being fun, you know, as opposed to now she's dressed up as, you know, Mystique from X-Men attacking Marvel. And it's like, okay, but, what is this for? You know, like, are you trying to get a job in a Marvel movie?
I think that she's trying to get into a Marvel movie. She's like tweeting at them when she posted the photo, which is like, it's fun, but it's also one of the things where it's just like, girl, like, this is supposed to be a party. It's not supposed to be like,
do less. Right. And it reminds me too of the thing now where, you know, you do, it's nice if you do a costume and like the celebrity, like as a regular person, and the celebrity or something you dress as, the person whose character is sees it. Like if you're Buffy, you know, like Sarah Michelle Gellar sees it. That's cute. You know, like I'm sure everyone who dressed as Florence Pugh tagged her and is hoping she sees it. she sees them. Okay. And she's moving on. But, you know, like, now it seems like a point of doing it so that you could tag the person so that they notice it. Mm. And then you get like a BuzzFeed spread or something, you know?
Oh, yeah.
What happened to pure innocent fun?
It's like everybody dressing up their kids in these costumes. I'm like, your child asked to be a fireman. Your child did not ask to be Kate Blanchett in Tar. That's not what your child asked for.
That's not what they asked Lewis for. Might have asked.
Yeah.
Also, speaking of Kim, again, once again, tomb raiding.
Yes.
She like putting Michael Jackson's Smooth Criminal hat on her child with the makeup still on it from Michael when he wore it. Girl, stay out of people's crypts.
Yeah, we need to not let her buy these estate sales. No. She's coming in with a big basket and just like shoveling things in it.
Her house in Calabasas is about to turn into the house on Haunted Hill. Okay,
that's
the spirits are coming.
No, my southern roots, the lineage, the ancestors are speaking to me. Like, I just, something about that, like taking somebody's things like that, like a person who's passed on and playing with them, say on the Met Gala red carpet or playing with them, like giving them to your child when they have not even been washed because they're that valuable. Like that hat had not been cleaned because it's that valuable. I just don't plan those type of things. I don't know. I'm superstitious. I'm like, that's not good. Also, I've seen Tales from the Hood too many times. Like, I play about things like that.
Kim would be, honestly, Kim would be a great, like, white villain in one of the Tales from the Hood segments.
Absolutely.
When you think about horror movies, honestly, I am still terrified by the little tiny black dolls that chased that man in the kitchen.
That man who was a sellout.
Yes. Yes. And also, I'll never forget the fact that, like, the white man in the film referred to them as nigglets.
I'll never forget.
The little tiny black people. That word has been stuck in my head since that movie.
Yes. I was like, now that's a slur. I hadn't heard before. I was like, now that's a new one. That's a new one.
That's art. Lastly, Brittany, what were you for Halloween? Did you partake?
I was not anything for Halloween. me and my husband, we've been busy lately. We hadn't really been able to spend time together. Oh my God, I feel like this is such a, I feel like a wife guy right now. So we went out for the day. Whenever we need to recharge together, we will go out to eat, get a foot massage, and go to the movie.
Wow, that's iconic.
In that order.
So that's what we did. Yeah. We went for a long walk and we got a foot massage. Then we ate and then we went home and went to bed. So I did not do anything.
You know what? I love conversation and verbal elation. Okay, you take that long walk around the park after dark.
It was giving our day was giving Lizelle an E flat. I'm not gonna lie.
Who is Jill Scott? Words in Halloween, Volume 1. Yes.
I'm not having a kid unless they want to dress up as Jill Scott in the number one ladies detective agency.
Okay.
Iconic DVD cover. Yes.
Yeah. I did a very lazy costume. I dressed up as Freddy Krueger. But I feel like, you know, even a lazy costume is sort of better than some people's lazy costumes, you know? I mean, we're not going to drag them this year, but because we've done it before. But, you know, like the gays putting on like a like ears for a costume, like if you're supposed to be like a superhero or something and then just shorts and nothing else, it's not giving anymore. You know, it's like we're constantly at odds with the you know, the stereotype that we're so creative and smart, and then just constantly undermining it in public.
And we're thrilled.
And we are back with our favorite segment of the episode. Brittany, as our guest, you go first.
Okay, so we all know that Elon Musk bought Twitter. Mm-hmm. And I can't tell at this point whether, I'm talking about the experience of using Twitter, whether or not it's changed mm-hmm. that much, or if I'm mostly just seeing people talk about what they heard is changing, or anticipation over what could change or what's about to change. And I do anticipate that things will change. However, all I see every day is people talk about how they're about to leave Twitter. They're like, I'm leaving. I'm not going to be here anymore. And then they show up the next day and they're tweeting like it's their damn job. Like they literally need to punch in to a fucking clock to be here. And my thing is this. I see people there. They're like, I'm going to leave here. Y'all can find me at Instagram. I'm going to leave here. We're going back to Tumblr. I'm going to tell you something right now. I don't know. I see these kids and they're like, oh, I was on Tumblr 2012 to 2016. Baby, I am your elder. I was on Twitter. I was on Tumblr, excuse me, in 2007. Okay. And I got off of it in about 2015. The things I have seen, and you joke about going back there, like that's going to be so much of a better place. Like, literally, people used to get up in arms. People would be doxing each other. People were trying to go back in people's lineage to find out who their great auntie was. People were leaking addresses. The girls were always fighting on Tumblr in the nastiest, freakiest ways. And my thing is, Twitter, I wouldn't necessarily say is better, but I think a lot of the things people complain about with regard to Twitter, aside from like, you know, like, aside from like racist and Nazis. Violent trolls, right? A lot of the same in-group, like ugliness and fighting, happened on Tumblr. It happens on literally every social media platform. So I don't want us to get these rose-colored glasses looking back toward the past, thinking that going to Tumblr is just going to solve everybody's problems, because baby, it will not. I'm tired of people getting on Twitter every day to complain about how they're about to leave. Or rather, I don't mind people complaining, actually, because like I complain about it too. I think complaining is fine. I think I'm just tired of people saying they're going to leave and then they don't leave. Do it. Don't do it. There is no try. Just leave one day and don't come back. Because there's plenty of people who I adore who left Twitter with no explanation and just never came back. Maybe they'll tweet once a year. Like, I wrote a book. Good for you. That's great. I think that they're healthy and I aspire to be like them. I really, really do. But I just don't want to see any of y'all who have been going on and on and on about how you're about to leave the platform. I don't want to see y'all here in 6 months. I don't want to see you here in 6 months.
There's something specific about like going on about that kind of thing on Twitter where it's like, you clearly want, I'm sorry, attention. Like you want people to respond and say something. Yes. And it's like that, by the way, like we all want attention. I'm not saying that's not like a human need or whatever, but like you said, it's not hard to leave. Like you can just delete it from your phone. So there's no like, it's not like you have to wait to be approved to leave or whatever. You know, it's like.
Or you could get banned, you know?
banned, right.
The cleanest leave of all, yes.
The cleanest. And you know what it reminds me of too? Mm-hmm. Do you remember the era of, you know, like why I left Twitter article?
Yeah.
I think Lindy West might have had one. I think other people, you know, it's just from people who, it's just like, I've left Twitter and here's an essay about why I left Twitter. Like, people loved it. Like, there used to be the Why Left BuzzFeed thing.
Yes.
People want you to know why they left. And I think the actual thing is, as a person who tried to leave Twitter before, never announced it, but tried, they always drop the you can follow me here. The problem is, all the engagement that you get on Twitter, and if you have, like, however many followers, like 500K or something like I used to have or something, like mm-hmm. all of those people are not going to follow you to Instagram and your next platform. So that's the main problem, I feel like, why these people don't leave. They want them to follow and then they're like, oh, two people followed me on my Instagram. It's like,
right.
People don't cross-pollinate, okay?
No, they like you where very they specific, see you.
Right. It's your close friends who follow you on Instagram and Twitter. Or, you know, but it's usually like one person wants to see your photos. or one person likes your thoughts, and that's it. Exactly. Rarely, like if you meet a random stranger who likes both, then maybe you're supposed to get married.
Although I will say, I probably for professional reasons will need to start a newsletter, and I will absolutely be posting on Twitter that people can follow me there. So when I do it, it's going to be different. For everybody else,
good to know.
But yeah, no, I'm just like, I'm like, do it, leave, don't leave. I don't care. Do whatever you want to do. It's probably going to get worse on Twitter, and it is what it is. Like, I might just be nosy and stick it out. I might not, we will see. But whether I stay or go, I'm not telling anybody, especially because as you said, Lewis, like, I don't want to be seen as somebody who like made a big thing about leaving and then comes
I
back.
I truly love the people who vanish. Okay. The people who vanish, but then like also like they'll tweet one thing or you go to their timeline, you're like, oh, they don't tweet forever, you know, but they're still around. I actually appreciate the people who sort of vanish, but when you go to their likes, they're still on it. They're still liking things.
Yes.
But they're like, I'm not engaging anymore. That's being an adult.
I think it's chic. So that's my thing. I think that if you're going to complain every day, it's like people who get on, there's all these people who are like, oh, don't talk about yourself. Don't share the photos. And I'm like, I'm literally not seeing any of these things happen. I feel like you're just tweeting something to have something to say when you could just really say rest in peace and we can move on. Or sometimes people, they'll just be Twitter infighting and someone will get up in the morning and be like, today's going to be a hard day on here. I'm going to leave. 3 p.m. Where's their ass? Right back on fucking Twitter. So right. I don't need to fucking hear it. Save it. Keep
it. People say things like that and then don't specify. It's like, are you under the impression you're better than Twitter? Like, give me a break. It's just not true.
Come on. I know I'm not.
Yeah,
I'm
right.
A try hard ass bitch. And if I hadn't been on Twitter for the better part of the last decade, I would not have the same job. I wouldn't have some of my friendships. I wouldn't have the professional relationships and opportunities that I've been able to have. I'm not going to sit here and act like Twitter, even though it can be irritating, I'm not going to act like it hasn't been a really fantastic tool for me to be able to get things that I appreciate.
We are not better than it, okay? James Baldwin would be on Twitter
every day.
Having takes where I'd be like, you know what? Let me put Giovanni's room away for a minute. I'm sorry. At a certain point, when you get old enough and you don't want to change your opinion about things, like, we would be disappointed by a lot of people. Who would be on this platform, okay? Tupac would be very embarrassing.
Oof,
on Twitter.
Right, I've never thought of that about that before, but you did say something just now. I mean, I'm not saying I'm for sure that's what would happen, but it's a possibility.
Oh,
I think about Marilyn Monroe on Twitter, okay?
Right.
Come on.
No, see, actually, I think Marilyn Monroe would not be on Twitter. I think I think she'd be on there, and then I think she'd be one of the people that just, like, forgot about it and left. And then,
yeah,
like,
right. It would not nourish her.
And maybe
her.
Sometimes, for shits and giggles, she'd go through and she'd like messy stuff, and then that would be
yeah. Actually, Kim Kardashian has Marilyn's Twitter account. So, Lewis, what is your keep it this week?
Mine's going to be quick. I'm just going to lament the death of the Billboard Hot 100, because Taylor Swift released the Midnights album, which we talked about last week, and now she gets to be the top 10 on the chart. Yes, I'm aware it's an extremely popular album, and I'm aware that technically that means all these people are buying the single, whatever, and that, you know, but like still, like, radio play is mostly about the main singles like Antihero, and it just means the chart is like kind of meaningless now. I don't know. I once upon a time really valued what it meant to have a number one hit, and now that's shifted so much. Like, the idea that now Mariah Carey is guaranteed to have a number one hit every Christmas, where before she was never in the running, the metrics have shifted, the what goes into the chart has shifted, and I just don't care anymore. And also, I'm a little sick of Taylor Swift fans being like, we did it. We got the top 10. Yes, she's wildly popular. What? Like, what? Like, you're pretending. It's like a Christian being like, yes, there's other Christians out there. Gentle fuck, we live in a Christian universe. Jesus.
Yeah.
I always feel that the top 10 should be songs that people are listening to. And I get that, like, Swifties are buying a ton of songs. Like, listen, I bought the vinyl, okay? I'm part of the problem.
Yeah, right, I see it.
And but...
Wow.
The single and everything counting for it still feels so weird to me, because I feel like if a song is on the top 10 on Billboard, my cashier at Panera Bread should know this song.
That is correct.
It should have been playing constantly, and they should be sick of it by now.
It should
now.
Be unavoidable. You know?
Yes. The top 10, like, the songs are unavoidable. And for me, yes, these are wildly popular, and Swifties are streaming them in their homes. So if you ask anybody on the street, do you know Bejeweled? They'd be like, the girl who lived in her car?
Yeah.
Shout out to the Jewel song Standing Still, by the way. I missed the early 2000s.
Anyway. That was a good song. No, but I 100% agree.
And also, there was the other thing, too, about, like, it's the first top 10 that's all female.
Don't even say that to me.
And I'm like, okay, Jack Antonoff wrote and produced every song on it. So it's also the first top 10 where one producer produced every song on the top 10.
Right. Anyway, you could have guessed that was my keep it. Ira, what's your keep it?
My keep it is like sort of sad. My keep it goes to the star of Netflix's series Heartstopper, Kit Connor, literally having to come out as bisexual at 18 because people on Twitter accused him of queer baiting for not saying whether or not he was bi for playing a bi character on the show. What the fuck is wrong with people?
Well, they must have expected him to be straight or something, right? Otherwise, why would they like harp on him so much? Anyway, not that that would make it excusable, but just, this person is now in a completely uncomfortable position. He's 18 years old, and how can you not feel bad for this person?
He's so sweet, and I feel like he's so sweet, and he's been so engaging with fans. And the thing that makes it kind of worse is that the entire series is about this. Right. Like, the whole point of it is about coming out on your own terms and when it's time. And, you know, like, you shouldn't be forced to, like, do anything before you're ready to. And he literally just had to do that. And I think that there's a disconnect between him and, like, I don't know, like, a straight actor playing a gay role. Like, he's not Eddie Redmayne in, you know, The Danish Girl or something, you know? Like, he's not Jared Leto playing a role, you know? He's not an actor trying to win an Oscar by playing an LGBTQ plus role, you know? Like, this is a kid playing a role, and it's, I don't know, I don't know how you could care about any character's sexuality when they're 18 or whatever, playing a role, you know?
I think it's inappropriate. And I also think it's just like people feeling entitled to have information about other people's lives. And I don't know. I just, that's, it makes me really sad. It's very disturbing. And I even just seeing the way people have treated Shawn Mendes over the years, I will admit, I've never heard a Shawn Mendes song. I don't know what he sounds like or what he sings about, but
unfortunately you have, because they are at Panera. My other caveat about a top 10 song is you either know everything about the song and you hear it all the fucking time, or you hear the song all the fucking time, but you also have no idea who sings it.
Right, right.
Then maybe that's Shawn Mendes. But what I do know, even though I don't know any of his songs, I do know that that poor young man has had people hounding him for years about his sexuality. And my thought is like, it's just not like, I don't know. I can understand why people want to know if there are people in the public eye who are like them. But I don't think that should ever override like somebody being able to keep their life for themselves and not feel so, I guess not feel so consumed. You should be able to have...
It's entitlement.
It's absolutely entitlement.
It's entitlement, because there's also... I don't know. There's this weird thing, too, about this where it's you want representation and feeling like you are connected to someone, but sometimes it jumps over to the level of like Annie Wilkes behavior from Misery, because it's like, if Shawn Mendes is gay, if this Kit Connor is bi, it's like, it doesn't mean he's going to date you.
Yeah, is that part of the
right
equation?
It's like him being queer all of a sudden doesn't mean that like it improves your chances of being with that person.
I also think, like, to me, what's weird is, like, this is a show we watched months and months ago. Everybody generally liked it. We put it away. And now, still, he's being hounded by people who are, like, still obsessed with that moment or whatever. Or now that it's been months, they feel like maybe they can get him to respond to him or something. I don't know. It just feels like people inventing a conversation where there wasn't one. And he's so surrounded by it. He's so bombarded with it. He then feels obligated to say something. When I just want to tell him, it's like, you didn't have to say anything. You know, like there's no like the thing in his tweet where he's like, okay, fine, I'm out, is like, I'm sorry someone tricked you into believing you had to do that.
Exactly.
Thank you to Brittany Luce for being here, the new host of NPR's It's Been a Minute. And thank you to Nina Haas for joining us. That's Keep It. We'll see you next time. Keep It is a Crooked Media production. Our senior producer is Kendra James. Our producer is Chris Lord. Our executive producers are Ira Madison III
and Louis Fertel.
Our editor is Charlotte Landis, and Kyle Seglin is our sound engineer.
Thank you to our digital team, Matt DeGroot, Nara Malkonian, and Delon Villanueva for our production support every week.